Well, anyway, thanks for coming tonight, even on a special night of Valentine's, and you brought your Valentine out here, or if you didn't, that's fine too. We're into our little calendar here. I got a new one for you today, which we'll look at in a minute, so I won't stop on those first ones, but I'm going to do a little review kind of over the top and see if you recognize what I'm talking about. It's going to be scary if you don't. But, you know, you missed lessons and so forth, maybe they're holes. So I kind of give you the overall shot to where we are. It's kind of good to do that. I mean, I really think we need to do it a lot. They do it for me even just to, you know, hit the high point. So we're going to do that, and then we're going to go into the part that moves our lesson along. And we're doing this not necessarily chronologically. We're doing it almost like the Bible does sometimes. It deals with subjects topically. Now, there's a chronology that underlies it, but the chronology in many cases is not that important, not significant. So anyway, our study of the Great Awakening could as well be entitled Christianity in Early America. We're going to start down the time of the Pilgrims, and we're going to go on through till probably up to our age, Lord willing, he tarries. So the period of the permanent settlement of America by the Pilgrims, 1620, is the beginning of National America. And it has Christian roots, even democratic ideals. I'm not sure Christian roots and democratic ideals are actually biblical. Some want to make freedom a biblical issue. I think ultimately it can be, but I'm not sure it has to be in government. But those are the ideals that started this country based on Christian principles. The document, which was the Mayflower Compact, was signed by all the Pilgrim passengers on the Mayflower. And this was really sort of smart. They signed it before they put the foot on, set foot on the ground, because I guess if somebody didn't sign it, they could stay out the ocean. So no duress here at all. Just, but everybody did sign it. That was a Puritan or a Pilgrim, not necessarily on the boat. Everybody on the boat was a Pilgrim either. But those that were Pilgrims signed it as the Mayflower Pact. Becomes a pattern for the rest of our government, which has to do with their personal freedoms. The effort of the Pilgrims, who were separatists, remember, they're not Puritans, they're separatists, was supplemented 10 years later with the arrival of the Puritans, who were not separatists, but they were loyal members of the Church of England, not so much for the separatists. Remember, the Puritans stayed inside the church, the separatists came out of the church. That's why the name is separate, have a separatist name. And so we have our interest here. We have the Church of England up on top is sort of like there always. It comes out of Catholicism, out of which comes Luther, Calvin, and the Pilgrim separatists. And then we have the Puritans who stay inside the church, foment trouble inside the church, and actually becomes the predecessors to the people in America that will be experiencing the Great Awakening. Now, off to the side, we have, again, Catholic, who come, the forerunners of the Anabaptists, which come out of the Reformation, practice adult baptism, not infant baptism, believe in the new birth. And this leads into our early America as Baptists. And we have only 25 Baptist churches in 1740, and it blossoms to like over 300 by the time you get to 1800. So this is a tension between the evangelical preaching awakeners and the Baptist adult baptizers. And I'm sure people went back and forth between these two, mostly out of the Reformed churches or out of the Church of England into the Baptist churches, or they planted new churches. Now, underneath all this, these are the formative years, and we want to spend, we got one more week, I think, on the Great Awakening, and then we're going to spend a little time on the formative years before the Revolution into the Enlightenment periods, a little bit of that, and then we get into the Second Awakening. So that's where we're going. So I'm talking about the period of time we're in now is the formative years for America. And the Great Awakening is there's an issue, a question about that. How much did it contribute to the Revolution of America? And that's something we're going to look at, study, and make some comments about that, but not yet. So that's where we are. And the thing that I want to remind ourselves of, and I forget, that the real issue in the Awakening preaching was they preached the new birth. That was not done in the Church of England. You wonder, what did they preach? Well, it's sort of like they preached like Israel. They were new Israel. So they were born into the church, they were baptized into the church, they were church members, and they just were Christians, you know, they were Christianized. But the fact that they would preach the new birth was something that was unheard of, and so when Whitfield and Jonathan Edwards preached it, and there were others, many others that were preaching it, they were really outside the mainstream. So I want to come back, what's the real issue in the Great Awakening? It was that they're preaching the new birth. And they didn't change the church polity. They didn't change a lot of other things like the infant baptism. They continued to practice that. But they did preach the new birth. And that's what made them, quote, successful, at least for that time being. Now, the intention was, now talking about the pilgrims here, their intention was to plant a Christian nation with principles or ideals from the Old Testament and Christianity. Old Testament and New Testament, mostly from the Old Testament. They saw themselves as the new Israel, God have rejected the original Israel. And in many ways, as they could, they acted the part of the new Israel, utilizing much from the old Israel forms. They drew themselves under the law of Moses. At least they were consistent at this point. We're going to be under the law. We got to be under the law of Moses. And they broadened the baptism to be a new circumcision. So baptism acted as a sign of or as a statement of belonging to the covenant, and the covenant here is a made-up term. There was no covenant, but they assume now that they were baptizing the children into a covenant relationship, a contract relationship with God. Assumed, again, there is no such thing. But they assume now that this baptism occurred, that there's this contract that this child had with God, somehow related to his redemption. Somehow. So all Israel received circumcision in the Old Testament. Therefore, all new Israel receive baptism. But baptism did something that circumcision could never do, never claimed that it could do, was that baptism made the baptized end a member of God's household, a Christian. That didn't happen when you were circumcised. That was, I'll read about this in a minute, but when you became baptized, you became a Christian because you were baptized. But we have a problem. All baptized members were not born again. Obviously, children, babies are not born again. Now, without any means of excluding them from membership, these babies grow up into these churches. Unbelievers grow up in the churches as members and become leaders, even pastors, though still unregenerate. Now, there were some that objected to this, like the Mathers, but, you know, that was the general diet. Now, I made a note here on my sub-note here, circumcision number one. Circumcision never made a person a Jew, but Jews were to receive circumcision, showing that they were family members of the promises. And the baptism, they tried to do that, obligate God to a covenant that they would now be Christians like the Jews were, the Israelites were Jews by virtue of their circumcision. Well, they misunderstood circumcision. So, therefore, they misunderstood and misunderstand present-day baptism. With the unregenerate in the church leadership, the church begins to sink into a state of apostasy. Complete apostasy is held off by believers in the church sometimes. The church is like a boat with a hole in the bottom. As long as the faithful combats the error, the boat remains afloat. But if the hole grows larger or the faithful can no longer bail out the errors, the boat will sink. And this is exactly what happened for the Puritans after about 10 to 20 years in America. The Puritans in the late 1840s and 60s saw their boat sinking and used ineffective methods to plug their holes. The leaking hole was infant baptism. I call it the poison pill. As long as the church practiced infant baptism, the church would have the unregenerate in it to corrupt it, no matter how godly some members are in the church are. So the Puritan boat was to sink, and it sank until Edwards, and Edwards tried to stop it, and for that he got fired from his church. Various measures were attempted to stop the flooding, but none worked. We had the half covenant, and we had the full open communion that anybody would come. And Solomon Stoddard went so far to say that the communion service was actually a message or given to the unbelievers, so if they partook of it, they could see the death of Christ in it, and they would be converted, because he was converted at a communion service. So they misrepresented what communion really was, and they perverted it as something for everybody So they went that far to try to preserve the boat from sinking. Now, even the awakenings did not stop the baptism of infants. And the effect, I think, are still observable. This is like called the poison pill. And until they get rid of the poison pill, the church that practices infant baptism are going to continue to find this generation. There may be some revivals, but there's always this degeneration because the unregenerate come into practice, come into leadership of the church. Now, Isaac Backus is an interesting story. If you read about his testimony, he believed in infant baptism, and he migrated from that to a believer's baptism, but it wasn't like overnight. And I have noticed this, that whenever a person changes his view on something, it doesn't happen overnight. It's a slow process. I mean, for the good or for the bad. If you go to the good, it takes a while. For the good to the bad, it maybe goes faster sometimes. But anyway, he didn't believe in infant baptism anymore and became a leader in the Baptist churches. So believer's baptism was practiced first in Switzerland. Just to give you a little background here. Started 1525 after the Reformation started. Spread to Elizabethan England during the Puritan times. Then to America, Roger Williams established a colony we now call it Rhode Island, in 1631. And out of this comes the great Backus, Isaac Backus, leader, 1724 to 1806. So that's exactly the period of time the first awakening occurred. And so here we have the Baptist churches in 1740. There were 25 of them in the colonies, and they drove to 312 by 1804. So a great increase. Some of those were new plants. People came out of the churches that practiced infant baptism. They saw the corrupt leadership, and I'm not saying all the Baptists have leaders that are not corrupt, but there's a little bit, there's nothing built into their system that would cause it like it is with infant baptism. So we have churches, schools. Interesting that these schools are still around. In fact, we have Rutgers now in our conference we play. We have Brown University as a Baptist school. We have Princeton was Presbyterian. Rutgers was Reformed, and Dartmouth was Congregational. And these schools, I suppose, you always plant schools to preserve the faith. And it's always interesting that the schools that are to preserve the faith are the ones that usually destroy the faith. Sorry about that. It's the way it is. So new Baptist churches were formed and grew. The awakening of the 18th century was largely within the Pado Baptist Church of 10 for baptism churches. There were a few Baptist churches I mentioned already. As Whitfield's ministry swept through the colonies, the awakenings were in the established Church of England churches. That's really where the awakening occurred. Well, there weren't that many Baptist churches to begin with. As he preached against the practice of unregenerate in the pulpit to his own endangerment, many churches did not, could not, change this reality. Some left the local churches to form new ones, and of course some were Baptistic, practicing believers' baptism. I don't mean that every church formed was a Baptist church, but a lot of them were Baptist churches. So our task has been to trace the awakenings where Mr. Whitfield ministered England and Wales, which is Western England, Scotland, Northern England, so to speak, and then America. Now we know that he was an ordained Church of England itinerant preacher, self-appointed in a sense. He was a preacher of the outer doors in the shadows of the Church of England. That is, when he could not preach in the churches, he went outside. And that's where he had his great ministry, because he had such great crowds that came to hear him preach. Whitfield was saved and was 25 years old, preached when he was first sermon at 22, and he was an international sensation by the time he was 24. Now try that on for size, for a career. And again, preaching the message of the born-again gospel is what made him different, besides his talent. Now we pick up Whitfield in our lesson, anticipating his second trip to the colonies. Been there once, he's going to go back. So his first trip was 1738 to Savannah, Georgia. Within the year 1738, he went there and came back. In his absence, the second time now, in his absence, he had John Wesley cover the preaching duties at Bristol. Now, this is on his second trip. I don't want to confuse you now. The second trip, he had John Wesley cover his preaching duties in Bristol. Now, this was after Wesley had betrayed Whitfield's trust by proceeding to preach against predestination, which he said he wouldn't do. Yet Whitfield turns the minister over to Wesley for the next 19 months without texting or email as Whitfield is in America. So you think he sails a little bit with a heavy heart, and I'm sure he does. So he says about his now, by the way, we're coming up on his high point. This trip is his high point of his career. It doesn't end here, but this is the most effective time. So he's been to Georgia once. He's been preaching in southern England a lot. He's had 10,000 people show up, and he preaches many times a week. All right. So he sort of has his legs, preaching legs. So now on the boat going to America, he says, the whole world is now my parish. Wherever my master calls me, I am ready to go and preach the everlasting gospel. The visit in 1739, 1741 witnessed the greatest awakening. It was undoubtedly the richest time of spiritual blessing in our nation's history. It's kind of an impressive statement to make. I didn't make that exactly. So we have up here the two trips. The one went to Georgia. That's the first one and returned. And the second one is a little difficult to follow all this along because he went back and forth. I'm just going to put him in north, and he goes south and north and south and north a bunch of times, and then he goes back to England. So those are the two trips that we have in mind today. Now, as Whitfield left England, he had great anticipations, as we already saw. But it was also a time of introspection, and this is something that Delamore writes about, that he became convicted of his pride. And when you're 24 years old, and you have these thousands of people come to preach, hear you preach, and you preach many times a week, it probably gets to you a little bit, like maybe you got something going for yourself. So he realizes that, and on this trip over, he stops to reflect, and he makes an adjustment on his pride. Then also unsettling was the beginning tremors of the lifelong conflict with John Wesley, which was just starting to come out into the open. Well, Whitfield was the peacemaker, and he will be absent for 19 months, during which Wesley is promoting his ministry by putting into print the message against predestination. Well, Whitfield, the single gentleman. But there's more to occupy Whitfield's mind on this journey, voyage, than on and his arrival in America. So it is on this Valentine's Day that we talk about courtship and the marriage prospects of George Whitfield. This is true history now. Before Whitfield left England, needing a place to wait for the boat to sail, accepted an invitation of Thomas Delamonte. All right, so he accepts the invitation of Thomas Delamonte, however you'd say it. Whitfield had made friends with the wealthy merchant business family's daughter, Elizabeth Delamonte. She and her sister had been converted by Charles Wesley's ministry at the Fetter Lane Society in London. We've seen that before. Now, according to Delamore, Whitfield had never allowed himself a close friendship with any member of the opposite sex. But now, although he fought against the tendency, he found an affection for Elizabeth forcing itself into his heart. Now, this brings up the question for many young men who have to address their burning passions to preach Christ. Is there any room for another? Is it possible that a love in life would detract from a fully devoted ministry? Whitfield was not the only one to face this question, as we will see tonight. Elizabeth 29, Whitfield 24, the relationship was everything but normal. It was in the nature of Whitfield's popularity that they were always in a company or a group. Whitfield was a man focuses on his preaching, on his ministry, and lives of others. Whitfield struggles with the intrusion into the life of a new love, which may have upset his expectations of himself. I just stop here and think. We rarely see this anymore. It's like seemingly young guys want to know what they can get out of it rather than, you know, what they can give. So I said, rarely do we see this kind of concern. Usually we see the opposite. Maybe that's common in our time. Well, Elizabeth must have understood that if Whitfield became her husband, always preaching in high demand and everywhere by everyone, the marriage would not be ordinary in any sense. Now, this may have given Elizabeth some misgivings, yet it appears that when Whitfield left for the colonies, the relationship seemed promising. And he was gone for 19 months, remember. Well, as we mentioned, the heavy matters that rested on Whitfield's heart, sailing to the colonies after arriving there, the status of the courtship seemed frozen. Out of sight, it's out of mind, somebody said. Sometimes they say also the absence makes the heart grow fonder. Probably the first for Whitfield. But when Whitfield came to Savannah, a letter from Elizabeth, now this was quite a while later because he went into the Philadelphia area first and then he went down. So it's been quite a bit of time since he has seen her. When Whitfield came to Savannah, a letter from Elizabeth waited him. Remember, it takes 4 months to make the loop. 4 months. But Whitfield dallies and does not respond. Well, he had felt that he could not truly love God if he allowed himself to love a woman. And since leaving England, he had told himself that he would put her out of his mind. But the letter reawakened, it had perfume. But the letter reawakened his affection, and he was thrust into his inward strife again. Well, he did write her. He began the letter. It's almost funny. There is nothing I dread more than having my heart drawn away by earthly objects like you. How romantic. Well, when that time comes, it will be over with me. So in other words, it'll be into my life, I guess. I mean, now remember, he's writing to this sensitive woman. But in the last paragraph, he redeems himself a little bit. He had revealed that he longed to be with her again in England. He talked himself into it again. Some comfort to Elizabeth. I talked myself into coming to see you again. Then later, traveling towards Philadelphia, Whitfield decides to propose marriage to Elizabeth. Typical of marriage arrangements, Whitfield writes the parents with a letter enclosed to Elizabeth. So the letter goes to the parents, and the parents approve of the marriage. Then they give that letter to the daughter. And remember, she's not a young kid anymore. She's 29. All right. Typical marriage arrangement. Whitfield writes the parents with a letter enclosed to Elizabeth if they approved of the proposal. Now, I got a little map up here, but don't just tell you that it's up and down the East Coast. Now, the letter for Elizabeth is not the typical proposal letter, but Whitfield is a realist and lays out her future life as his wife. If after seeking to God for direction, you can say, I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. Strange. What if you and I were joined together in the Lord and you come with me at my return from England to be an help meet to me in the management of the house? He's hiring a manager for the orphanage. And he says, I make no great profession to you. The passionate expressions which carnal couriers use, I think, ought to be avoided by those that would marry in the Lord. There's no romance here, is there? I trust I love you only for God. In fear and much trembling I write, and shall patiently tarry my Lord's leisure till he is pleased to incline you, dear miss, to send an answer to your affectionate brother, friend, and servant in Christ, George Whitfield. Well, when the ship reached Philadelphia, going back north, those letters sent her, and the response would take 4 months. All the while, the answer is not known. But while in Philadelphia, Whitfield does make a lifelong relationship with Benjamin Franklin. Just get to the context for a little bit. Perhaps that and other events, preaching so forth, busy schedule, ease the time for the wait. In the meantime, Whitfield has a fruitful ministry. We talked about the zenith of his ministry during this time. And I have on the left here the trips that he went back and forth, some by ocean, mostly by sea, one by land between the south and the north as he preached. Remember, he's there for 14 months preaching, the rest of the time he's traveling. So I'm not going to go through this, but you see he's been a busy guy up and down the colonies. Well, it was at Charleston that Whitfield received a copy of Wesley's Against Predestination sermon, another load. It was the first time that Whitfield realized that Wesley was circling the divisive document And now we would have to reply. He's sort of been sitting back, not really wanting to get to, you know, to, into the open and talk about these disagreements. But now that Wesley has done this, he's going to have to do this. Remember, Wesley based his whole premise on that he had cast a lot before the Lord, and that lot made it imperative for him to get this out to the public. And Whitfield's going to attack that, casting a lot as a direction from the Lord, and that's going to put Wesley in a bad spot that we had last week. Also, in passing, he mentions another disappointment. Never did seem to get the letter back from Elizabeth. Also, in passing, he mentions another disappointment that in the Blendon letters from Delamonte, I find that Mrs. Elizabeth Delamonte is apparently now a Moravian, changed her allegiance back to the Moravians, and that she is keeping company with William Holland. And they were married 5 months later, a couple of months after Whitfield returns to England. So he finds out this way that the answer is no. Maybe she owed him one. Remember, these things took a long time. Now, this William Holland, if you remember back from the days when we were talking about Wesley's conversion, he was the one that read Galatians to these men. And at least Charles was saved after that reading of Galatians. And that's the man that this guy, this gal, marries, will eventually marry. Now, we're still in New England. Another disappointment in the subsequent New England tour in the New South Church in Boston. I tried to chase this down. I'm not sure I have the right church, because this is the church where the two of my land, one if I see. And it seems to me that was the old South Church, the New South Church, but it's an old North Church. But they've got new churches that replaced the old churches. So I'm really confused. So it says that the top picture is where Whitfield preached. The bottom one, I'd say it was like that if that wasn't the one. This is the one where Paul Revere, you know, rode out and watched the land, or two by land, one by sea. That's the North Church. Okay, another disappointment in the subsequent New England tour in the New South Church in Boston. In the crowded gallery, someone purposely broke a board to make a makeshift seat. The folks thought that the gallery was giving away. The panicked crowd killed five and injured others. Hard. So leaving Boston, Whitfield visits now Jonathan Edwards. We had this last week, and just give you another context. The Whitfield sail, and then with January 16, Whitfield sailed for England. He had been in the colonies for 14 and a half months, and we had the travel time too, so he's gone 19 months. Whitfield returns to his darkest hour when he finds out what Wesley has done and how it's going for him back in England. We had last week's lesson on this. The dispute over God's sovereignty. And he had a fruitful ministry in Scotland for 3 months. That went well. So remember, he's an eligible single guy right now. Well, last week we met a young unmarried male, an evangelist from the Wales Revival region named Lowell Harris. We met him as a fellow Calvinist, bosom buddy of Whitfield. And he went there to preach revivals for him, because this Harris already had a revival going, so, you know, they preached for each other. Lowell Harris, following his conversion in 1735, had promised himself that henceforth he would give himself wholly over to God, and that no member of the opposite sex would ever have a place in his life. Sounds a little bit like Whitfield, doesn't it? But in 1739, he had fallen in love with the Welsh widow, Mrs. Elizabeth James. We've got to get these Elizabeths straight now. So we got Elizabeth I and Elizabeth II. So we're talking about Elizabeth, Mrs. Elizabeth James. Howell Harris is on the right, and the other ones, you see Whitfield in the middle. The other ones are noteworthy people in the Great Awakenings, but I'm not going to stop to identify them because I have not talked about them. Now, her affection for him, that is Elizabeth James for Lowell Harris, right, Howell Harris? Her affection for him, this mighty muscular man of God, was equally strong, and had he but proposed marriage, her answer undoubtedly would have been an immediately and rapturous yes. But he was never ready to make the proposal, and he thought that instead of returning to the condition he spoke of as having nothing between my soul and God, so Harris saw in Whitfield a means of escaping his entanglement. Since he thought so highly of Whitfield and was in love with Mrs. James, he felt he could performed the greatest favor to each of them by offering to step aside and suggesting that they would make an ideal marriage partner for each other. Upon Whitfield's return from America, Harris had written to him of his plan, and Whitfield arranged to see him. Now remember, Whitfield knows that Elizabeth number one is not an option anymore. So as they conversed, Whitfield asked if Harris really meant to give up his friendship with Mrs. James, and being assured he did, when Whitfield's ministry took him to the west of England, he crossed into Wales and visited her. He wrote to her from Scotland, believing that she was God's choice for him, and he rode to Wales with the intention of marrying her. Now, Elizabeth James, a widow, age 39, had a teenage daughter named Nancy, I think. So Harris speaks of her as having no beauty, youth, or riches, none but competency. So if you hear somebody say, how do you describe this person? Well, the very competent person, you know what they're saying. She has her own cottage by Abergavenny, where she lived with her daughter Nancy. Her qualities, however, were chiefly of the spiritual kind. Her letters are full of biblical quotations and abound in a mixture of sorrow for spiritual failure and joy that rose almost to ecstasy. There was a tenderness about her with which she often ministered to Harris and lifted him out of his despondencies. Well, Whitfield, when I have D up, that means that's Dollimore. Doesn't mean Don, so Dollimore saying this. Okay, Whitfield has arranged that when he reached Mrs. James' home, Harris would meet him there. And so he's prepared to marry her right away. But Mrs. James was not as ready as he. So Harris had first spoken of turning her over to Whitfield, that she had said. Now I wish I knew what she said here, because this English, the syntax is so bad. You may have to help me. She said that, and I'm going to add a little bit here, that even if you were my own father, you have or had no right of disposing me against my will. I mean, you can't decide for me. Now, the next one here, I don't know what she's saying here, but I think it's not good. Now, I'm just going to read it the way it is. Now, you might have to come later on and tell me what she actually is saying here. You say, ye thought of parting with her, ye Lord has made as your own soul was cutting till ye Lord let you see eternity. So I think that it's a rebuke in a sense, I think. I think that's what it says. So pray, because what she says next is pray, think what those thoughts must give me. But heartburn. So however you translate, it's clear that Whitfield carries on the most selfish courtship in the history of the United States or of the Americas. In fact, Dollimore had a paragraph about his manner of courtship, and I was going to find it. I couldn't find it again because he's really good about that. So I didn't want to put it in my words. I thought I'd put it in somebody else's words. So. But he, as you can see, was doing it somewhat differently. Now, Harris attempts to express his continued love for Mrs. James, but not as her husband. Thus, Mrs. James is confronted with making a great decision. Would you remain in the friendship of Howell Harris, the mighty man of the Welsh Hills, hoping he would someday propose marriage, or would she accept the proposal of George Whitfield, the famous George Whitfield, who's never home, the evangelist of international prominence, and marry him right away? One in a hand, two in a bush. Well, this is the dilemma Mrs. James faced. And by the time Whitfield had been in Abergavenny 4 days, she had made up her mind. She agrees to marry him. Now, the wedding was to be immediately, but as they went from church to church, no cleric would marry them. They went like the 3 or 4 churches. I guess they didn't have to get a license. I guess he went to the churches and they performed all that for you. Most because of Whitfield's notoriety as a renegade preacher. That's why they wouldn't marry them. Nothing wrong with the marriage. But finally, as Reverend John Smith, a friend of the Awakening, married them on November 14, 1741. Whitfield was 26, his bride was 36. Well, a marriage, yes. Now I have a little cottage, you know, in England or wherever you think. You know, maybe they might settle down. But a marriage to Whitfield will have none of the normalcy associated with the God-given institution. So Whitfield entered this new state, determined that he would in no way, that it would in no way interfere with his ministry. That's what he said. Now, Gilbert Tennant, one of the co-evangelists, wrote, says, I married, to him, he wrote, I married one who was a widow of about 36 years of age, not quite sure how old she was, neither rich of fortune nor beautiful as to her person, he writes this about his wife, but I believe a true child of God and would not, I think, attempt to hinder me in my work for the world. So it's his or whatever. Now, there was no honeymoon. They stayed at her cottage for a week where he preached twice a day in the area around them. Leaving Elizabeth and her daughter there, he set out to preach in Bristol, in Gloucester, and in London. After a month, he returned to Abergavenny for Christmas Day, but left the next day for Bristol and London. I shaded out the area where that is from where she is and where the, you know, London is, so that area, southern England. He described his manner of life, saying, I sleep and eat but little and am constantly employed from morning till to midnight. He apparently felt that he had succeeded in his determination to continue his ministry without distraction. After 3 months, Elizabeth joins Whitfield in London, vacating her home and renting new lodgings in London. That was expensive. As no beauty, she must have felt some self-consciousness as people there passed their opinions on her as they entered the tabernacle. Was this marriage a good and a happy one? Question mark. It is difficult to say, but they did work out an arrangement that continued to her death at age 63 after a short illness. She bore him a son who lived but 4 months. There were others possible, probably 4 miscarriages, and probably a stillborn child. Now, in this, there's probably a misfortune of a carriage incident, where one of these children would have suffered perhaps a fatal injury. It could have been the stillborn child. We don't know. That's sort of open there. Well, Mrs. Whitfield did accompany her husband to the colonies and to Scotland. And on his third trip, his longest, 1745 to 1748, lasted nearly 4 years, she went with him to America. Now, it would appear that this was not a good experience for her in that she felt in the way of the preaching and associated events. Whitfield did express appreciation that would suggest a good, although an unusual marriage. Now, we do have a picture of this woman. This was painted in 1742. It's not known for sure whether the woman looking up at Whitfield is his wife, but since she is in close proximity to him, and this was within a year of their marriage, it probably is her. No painter would have put another woman that close to the evangelist. So that's probably the best look at her. Now, I always have real time looking back in those ages whether those people were good looking or not. You know, I mean, the hairstyles and the dress and everything was just so different, and they were British. That's already you know, different. No makeup, right. That's right, not like in France. So I don't know whether she was a particularly unattractive woman or not, but according to their words, she was in their system. And never want to say anything about a woman that's not attractive, right? Well, I appreciate that there's somebody made the effort to give us an idea of what she looked like. Okay, Dalimore says that Whitfield referred to Elizabeth in such terms as my helpmeet, my dear partner, and my dear yoke fellow. To a husband and wife whose marriage brought them much contentment, he states, happy pair. I know by sweet experience the comforts that you enjoy. Lowell Harris referred to Elizabeth as a blessing and a glory to her husband and remarked, it is not that marriage of thine own making. Several similar items also could be cited, all manifesting their married happiness. When their son, now this is sort of the hard side of things. When their son died, Whitfield was off preaching. What do you think? When Elizabeth was with Whitfield in London, they could not afford the rented lodging, so she and her children, two of them, returned back to Abergavenny because they couldn't, you know, afford to live in London. By then, Whitfield had given away the furniture which she owned, and she needed to borrow furniture and get secondhand curtains to put up to make the house livable. You know, Whitfield did everything wrong. Now, of course, we see God at work in lives of so many in England, Scotland, her land, Wales, and the colonies. which must have softened the personal disappointment and the inconvenience of a normal home life with the family together. We know that our rewards are here or on earth or in the heavenly sphere in the glories of the kingdom. Ms. Whitfield will no doubt be at the top of the list for the big rewards, I am sure. It is a possible pass judgment on Whitfield's choices leading up to and including his marriages. I mean, it's hard to get in there and say, well, he should have done this, he shouldn't have done that. But the concerns of Whitfield and Harris that they could not serve the Lord devotedly while married is a wrong placed expectation. Now, again, Whitfield had that kind of life, that kind of ministry. He didn't sit still very long. I mean, if you would try to keep up with him as a wife, you know, I mean, I don't know, you would kind of feel like you're hanging around. So I can see why she might have felt uncomfortable with that. So I guess we don't want to form a judgment on her, because if God called Whitfield to do this, he'd probably been better off staying single. Who knows? But he didn't, so this is how it works out. So marriage is one of the divine institutions meant to make life more livable and productive, even for those in ministry. That's a general statement. To tell of one's devotion to the Lord, as he sometimes did, and compare a lack of that kind of devotion in a proposal makes Whitfield unthoughtful or even unkind, it seems. He may have thought about these reservations, but there was no need to saddle a woman with these aspirations to a higher devotion, which should go without saying. Remember, I tell my wife all the time, now remember, I love you a lot, but I love the Lord more. And you get that. That's supposed to be true, but you don't have to say it. So to explain that she is number two in life, which he always did, seems a convenience to deny the duty owed her as the first place. Now, Delamore states that the love between Elizabeth, number one, the one that he didn't get, was likely true love, and it took her 10 years, Elizabeth, number one, to overcome her feelings for Whitfield, even though she married somebody else. So it seems that as Whitfield married another, he had said that he was called upon to sacrifice his Rachel, the one he really wanted. Well, he dallied around a lot. What do you expect, I would say? So what may have been is a story many can tell, but we must leave these strange events in the hands of our Maker. Now, it may have been in the visit to Northampton, seeing Jonathan and Sarah Edwards in their marriage, a ministry model for Whitfield, which he had to quickly reject it. He didn't say it was possible. Now, again, Jonathan Edwards didn't move around. He lived at home. But by this time, after he saw this, the die was cast. Letters already, you know, been sent. He'd already got the rumor back that she's going to marry somebody else. But by this time, the die was cast. Whether Elizabeth, number one's parent, cooled their support is debatable. That's possible. Elizabeth never got the letter. But it seems like Elizabeth Delamonte would have been happy to be Mrs. George Whitfield. And George would have been content to live with Elizabeth, albeit it was the other one. All right, that is our Valentine's message.